But if we could take the brain of an experienced practitioner, experienced meditator, and have them get into that state of samadhi while in an imaging machine, and read the brain, which I'm sure they've done that work already, then taking that brain scan and using it to train or teach somebody else what that state of being is, to help them to learn the meditative practice. My name's Kenley Neufeld. I live at Deer Park Monastery, and I have for several years. I'm a Dharma teacher in the Plum Village tradition. I've been a student and practitioner of meditation for a little over 25 years. And most of my career as a professional person was in education. And in particular, I was a librarian before I became a dean. And throughout all of those years, I would probably consider myself a technologist. So I'm trying to let go of my technologist knowledge and skills and understanding, but it is also very difficult to do so, as you can imagine. Once it's kind of, for me, it's, you know, I walk up to a computer and it's not a fear in any way. I'm not afraid I'm going to break anything, or it's also something that is very easy for me to use. Like, I can just do it. And whereas I watch other people who struggle with that ability. And so that's where I get to practice meditation and mindfulness, because when I have to look over the shoulder of a friend or a brother doing something, I have to be very patient and kind. And
When they're using a computer.
Yes. Yes. Like today, I did a project where I had to send, you know, a few dozen emails. And all the emails were essentially the same, except for one little snippet of it. So, you know, I wrote a little script so that the snippet would go in automatically, so I didn't have to type it every time. So
now, did you use ChatGPT to write that script?
I did not write ChatGPT to write that script. Okay. Although I probably could have, right? I probably could have gone in there and asked how to do it. But I knew where the tools were already on my computer to do that, and I used that. And it wasn't perfect. I got to spend another half an hour writing something where the emails got put in automatically, like a mail merge thing. But Apple Mail and Gmail don't do mail merge, so you have to write a script to do it. And I didn't want to take the time to write a little Apple script.
That's
very technical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good that you haven't quite left the technologists behind, because that's the part of, I guess, what we want to explore in Mindful Conversations. So, so we're here for the Wisdom Conference, and Shamash and I have been talking a lot recently about the future of what does the species look like, the human species look like? How can we continue to embed mindfulness, wisdom, with the advent of this AI technology that's taking off? And I just wondered what your initial thoughts were.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I've always had technology around me, and so I really appreciate what it is and what it offers and what it's able to be in terms of enhancing our lives and enhancing our practice. And there's a whole school in the mindfulness community that's probably a Luddite and is very anti-technology. I'm certainly not in that category. I think we can use technology in a way that can weave together communities and also to enhance our practices. We've seen over the last decade with the meditation apps that have come out. So I went to Wisdom. It's probably been over 10 years since I went to a Wisdom conference, but I did go to the first few in the whatever they call those time periods, in the aughts. And I remember going to one of them, and this might have been a couple of years later, there was a company called, I want to say they were called Sphere, but I don't think they were. But they sold this little, they had this little like rock thing that you put on your belt, you know, and it would monitor your body, movement, tensity, etc., and would alert you if you needed to like slow down or pause. So, and it worked with a mobile device. And yeah, it was very interesting. I don't think they're around anymore. As with a lot of the the meditation apps, I think, have come and gone over time as well. So it's really exciting to kind of see where things might turn in the future without rebuilding what's been done in the past. Certainly with the advent of AI as it develops, because it's still in development, very much so. Mm-hmm. Other than things like, you know, when you pull out your phone and you take a selfie, the computer knows and recognizes your face. That's AI.
That's AI, yeah.
You know, that is exactly AI, that the computer can recognize your face for the photo.
Wow.
And we take that for granted, I think, as mobile phone users. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just works. And people probably don't think of that as AI, mm-hmm. but it is. So, you know, as that field grows into other areas, whether it's through neurofeedback type work or training people how to meditate, for example, I think there's a lot of possibility there. One book that I'm reading that came out a few years ago, I just want to mention this because I shared it with you earlier, is Bewilderment by Richard Powers. And in that story, they take a brain scan of somebody and they use that brain scan to train somebody else in terms of like the emotional state that that person was in during their brain scan, and using it to, in a way, to map new connections in this person's brain. And if that's possible in the future, which certainly authors typically look at things that have already been kind of in development to some degree, and I haven't done any research on it yet. I suspect somebody's working on this. But if we could take the brain of an experienced practitioner, experienced meditator, and have them get into that state of samadhi while in an imaging machine, and read the brain, which I'm sure they've done that work already, then taking that brain scan and using it to train or teach somebody else what that state of being is, to help them to learn the meditative practice. And so that's, if that's possible, that sounds pretty cool in some ways. I mean, I don't think it's skipping all the, you know, years of practice of sitting under a tree and saying om and all those things, you know. It's like,
you can skip that.
You can skip that part. But it might get you to, you know, it might assist people who maybe aren't able to do that first stage practice to kind of like get a little jump start. And in that way, once they've learned some of those skills, then they can apply it in a way that can bring them to deeper understanding of themselves and deeper understanding of the world around them, and, you know, cultivate that compassion. And because for me, that's what all the meditation practice is moving towards. It's not about like necessarily being calm all the time or being able to be stable enough to do a task, but rather like gaining an understanding of myself in my own body. So anything with AI that can help you to gain a better understanding of your own body and your own thoughts and bringing that awareness to the surface is going to assist anybody to move towards what's our greater work, which is the bodhisattva practice of like taking care of each other, taking care of the planet, you know, in a way that we can heal our relationships in addition to understanding ourselves. So, some of the possibilities that are out there.
Yeah.
Really interesting. So do you think that it's almost like a feedback system or something that AI could use to help enhance people's meditation potentially? Do you think it could also help kind of nudge people or guide them to be kinder to each other, be compassionate to each other, cultivate wisdom? Do you think that's possible, or do you think
possible in theory, in the sense that if this kind of technology comes to the surface, that I think it's hard not to like develop that kindness and that compassion when you're understanding yourself. So anything that we can do to cultivate that understanding of ourselves, and maybe there are brain scans that can for someone who's super kind, or but I think it's more about just coming to understand yourself better, really, in the end. That allows you to be kind and allows you to be compassionate. Because we have to start here with ourselves, and in terms of, like, we understand ourselves and we understand enough to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves, so that in turn we can be kind and compassionate to those around us. And yeah, I think that that would be really sweet to have that kind of, it's not like a pill, you know, but it's kind of like a pill, right? It's like, you know, because there's always a risk of, like, you know, seeking that quick fix, you know. All these people that have done the meditation apps for the last decade or something, I think it's great. But is it really, like, transforming people? I don't know if it really, I think it, what it, for those who take it to the next level, it's transformational. So if it's just that tool, then it's not. But if you want to, you know, apply that in a greater way to transform yourself, not just have those 10 minutes or 5 minutes of meditation, but to be able to move beyond that to these other aspects of ourselves, I think would be more of a successful step. It's kind of like with a yoga. Yoga is super popular. People go to yoga studios, they exercise, they sweat, they hear a cheerleader, and so on and so forth. But if you look at the yoga practice, it's much deeper than that. It goes way deeper. And so some yoga practitioners move towards that, and others just stay here because they just want the exercise. You know, they're not looking for that that deeper understanding, that deeper practice. And so it's the same with meditation, I think, for people. That it's they enjoy those moments of time, and they don't seek out a need for something further. Or maybe they go to a retreat or a conference. I mean, that's a move in the... I don't know if I'd call Wisdom 2.0 like a meditative conference, but it's pretty intense, at least the times I've been there.
And, I mean, there's some interesting people. I mean, it's worth saying that, you know, for the listeners, Shamash and I are at Deer Park Monastery right now with you. So we're experiencing this peaceful place, this real oasis before the conference even starts, right? And when we get there, it it's going to be fast, and there's going to be a lot of action, a lot of connections and stuff happening. But this question about human civilization, and, you know, we were talking to Brother Freedom yesterday about suffering. And sometimes that suffering is the thing you need. What do you think about this shortcut? Would it remove the suffering and get us to the transformation faster? And then the effort gets put onto the transformation rather than the journey of the suffering? It's like a mountain climber, right? I'm just going to get to the bottom of the mountain, go up an escalator, get to the top, and then be like, wow, the view up here is amazing. It's incredible.
That's my kind of mountain climbing. I think that people, well, first of all, everyone has plenty of suffering to work with, and they don't need to create any more suffering. And people may not be aware of their own suffering. I think that's the first barrier. And so even with this kind of method, they will still need to look at their suffering, whether that's before, during, or after. And then suffering will continue also beyond, you know, well-being to some extent, because life still happens. But is it a shortcut? I don't think it is. Only because each of us has a journey, a path to take, to navigate from a place of suffering to a place of well-being. And for most of my adult life, I've been what I would consider mostly in a state of well-being. But then I had some great suffering in my 50s and early 50s. Very significant suffering, like life-threatening suffering. And through that experience and through healing beyond it, I've been able to look back over the prior 25 years and see that that was already there. That layer of suffering that I've experienced was present in me all those years, but I wasn't able to see it.
Yeah.
Because I was able to do things like work all the time, you know? And so there wasn't enough time for me to consider the suffering that was laying there the whole time. Yeah. And I think that is probably the case for a lot of people, to just not have that awareness of their suffering in their life, because they're able to very easily cover it up with work or with alcohol or with drugs or with meditation apps. So they don't really have to look at it. And it's only through some stillness and some spaciousness in your life that those things come to the surface a little bit more. When you have no place to hide anymore, essentially, that one can then see that this exists in us or in myself. And I don't regret not seeing it for 25 years. I did what I needed to do to survive in the world. And now in the second half of my my life, whatever that might look like, I'm going to do things differently. You know, and that's part of the reason I live here. I'm still working for the monastery at like a third of the amount of time that I worked in the world. And I still feel like it's too much work. I need more time, more spaciousness.
Let's speak to management about that.
I've got a question about AI and consciousness, because you know, at the moment, as we're speaking, we're on ChatGPT-4, and people spend time every day talking to it, mm-hmm. and it feels very real. They feel like it's someone that's supporting them. And as it develops potentially exponentially,
yeah.
it may start becoming more emotional, and people, you know, may treat it like a friend. Do you think that AI can, you know, there can be a consciousness behind it, just as humans are conscious on a good day? What are your thoughts about that, and how we relate to it? Is it possible for it to be conscious, do you think?
I don't know. I watched that TV series, Humans. It was kind of interesting. Consciousness in the AI. Well, they were AI, essentially.
Okay.
Robots.
Yeah.
It's the same idea, a robot with consciousness.
Okay.
Well, I honestly feel a little bit skeptical about that.
Okay.
And the skepticism probably arises from my... based on what I read a lot of science fiction, and I have my whole life, mm-hmm. right? And conscious AI is not a good outcome, typically, in science fiction writing. So I think I'm a little bit jaded from all the stories I've read about it.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because I watched The Mandalorian's most recent season, and at one... was it in The Mandalorian? I think it was in The Mandalorian. So at one... yes, it was. So a character has to go in for interviews like once a week or something with AI in the room. And they ask them questions like, you know, do you still feel happy with the amnesty program? Do you still feel happy with the government? You know, these kinds of things. And I'm watching this and I'm noticing that the AI is not picking up on the human nuances of facial expression, you know, touching faces and that sort of stuff. Because I'm watching it, I'm like, this dude's lying, right?
Okay, yeah.
And the AI is not picking up on it at all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
All the person has to say is yes, no, yes, no. And the AI is like, cool, you're done. You're out of here. So now Star Wars, you know, is a fantasy world also. But again, it's something that we have a lot of times, a lot of technology has arisen out of science fiction. Anyway.
We were discussing that today. Yeah.
And so I think that my skepticism arises from that. And I think that skepticism will filter through the developers of AI technologies as well, because a lot of those folks probably read science fiction too. They watch science fiction movies and so on and so forth. Mm. It would take, a significant amount of computing power that we may not have available to us yet to truly model and map a consciousness based on numbers, because that's what it would be doing. It's like modeling and mapping a consciousness based on ones and zeros. And I mean, yeah, I think theoretically it's possible. I'm not sure I would be comfortable with that future myself. It would almost be the development of a new species, essentially, created by another species.
Yeah.
So with our own flaws built into them. Because if you take any technology, whether it's Google search or, you know, facial recognition, AI, there's been lots of research and studies showing discrimination built into those systems.
True. That's true, yeah.
And they're built by humans, you know. So I think that that's the risk we take when we move towards a conscious AI. Because we can only create what we know.
Yeah.
Unless it can develop itself, which is ChatGPT developing itself? Is it learning?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah. So it does have a... Does that mean it has a consciousness?
Maybe.
It might. Mm. Yeah. Maybe we define consciousness differently when it comes to AI than human consciousness. Mm. You know, does a rock have consciousness? Maybe. We don't know. We're not a rock.
Mm. Well, have you watched Everything Everywhere All at Once? Two rocks having a conversation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's funny.
See, they have consciousness.
What makes you not that comfortable with the idea of this potential development, if theoretically possible? What is it that unsettles you about the idea?
I think it just arises from what's in my store consciousness, really. And I'm not sure if I can give a very good, like, analytical reason for it. I mean, there's been many things over time that have made people uncomfortable that are now ubiquitous, like cell phones, microwaves.
Yeah.
You know, so there are times when people are electric cars. I mean, that's going to happen. We're going to have fully automated driving cars at some point. It might be in 20 years, but it's going to happen at some point. And we'll look back at these days as, like, you know, the Wild West of, like, EVs and automated driving. So I reserve the right to change my view in the future. I think that for people like me who likes to spend time in front of the screen, I enjoy the time in front of the computer. My neighbor over here really does not like spending time in front of the screen, and he thinks I need to go out and do stuff, and I'm like, I'm enjoying myself. This is what I like to do. So I think that for people like me, a conscious AI could also be a risk to turn inward, because if there's a AI available to me, you know, I may, you know, reduce the amount of human-to-human contact because I am able to, because I can have the semblance of a relationship. Whereas I can take for instance, my son, who has a very difficult time with human to human interaction. It's not in his DNA to be comfortable in that realm, and he has a very difficult time communicating, has not really had a close friend since he was a kid in human form like this. But he's like super, super, super active on Discord with the same group of guys and gals daily, and they're his friends. Yeah. And it's like that's his core relationship, is that relationship with these folks on Discord. And you know, they talk all the time, they tell jokes, they laugh, they do the headphones, they do the chat, you know, the typing. And you know, would I like him to be more social with the, you know, human to human interaction in like touching environment? Maybe. I'm not even sure anymore. because, you know, he is able to gain this social interactivity that's probably way more than I do through Discord.
Yeah.
So it's a risk for me, who's very much an introvert, for a conscious AI. Whereas for him, it would be a godsend, you know, like, this is great, you know, to be able to have this, like, person to check in with or, you know, talk to, or, like, how do I, you know, make my dinner, you know, and that person can walk them through, that AI can walk them through how to make dinner.
Yeah.
Right now I have to make the dinner. So if there was an AI that could just hover in the Solidity Hamlet kitchen, that could teach him how to make his macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
It would make my... Then I can stay in here and be introverted.
And you can go on the computer more often. That was kind of linked to one of my next questions, actually, because, like you said, AI is already being used a lot, and I think it's being used a lot in social media.
Yes.
And also other apps to make them more addictive, so people spend more time on them. And you can use AI in a very powerful way to just nudge people in the right way to make them turn to the screen more often. So, you know, potentially... the future, the next 5-10 years, technology will become even more addictive. You know, people will be drawn to screens even more. How do you think mindfulness will potentially also grow in popularity as an antidote to that? Any thoughts about that, about the how technology can seems to be getting more and more addictive with AI?
People turn to mindfulness out of their suffering.
Yeah.
And so if it's causing them suffering, then yes. But if it's not, if they don't see it as a cause of suffering, then maybe not. So I don't think it'll be any different in the future in that regard than it is today. You know, the people that will turn to mindfulness may turn to it regardless of whether that AI is making you click more times than not. And stepping beyond that, I think that, you know, having an AI, consciousness AI, that has a three-dimensional form would be... That's what I'm talking about with the cooking thing, you know. It's like not just
robots
on the screen, but just like some. It could be hologram.
Yeah,
it could be hologram. You know, just install hologram.
What, hologram showing you how to cook?
Yeah.
Reminds me of a film, George Lucas' first ever film.
Oh yes, the THX.
THX 1138.
Yeah, I think
or 68.
I don't remember.
And there is all of that in.
Really?
You know, there's the hologram that gave the entertainment. There was the robot questioning, are you happy? Jesus loves you, and all of this in the mirror. Just going back to something you said about new species and all of that. Do you think the idea of AI augmenting the human species makes the human any less human? Or maybe a better way to ask the question is, in your experience, what would you say being human even is?
Well, I think that goes back to your previous question about consciousness, right? Because I think that a lot of us think that being human is consciousness. Although there are other animals and probably plants and minerals that have consciousness also, we just don't know. I think being human is something to do with our ability to have compassion and care for another entity, whether it's a human or a non-human. That element of love and that piece of the heart that just kind of like cares about something. And it doesn't matter where you land on a political spectrum or an socioeconomic landscape. I think every human deep down inside cares about something. And it could just be their own well-being. But most likely it's, you know, a parent or a child or a dog or a tree. You know, there's something that exists that there is some level of care for, awareness of. So I can't remember your question, but I hope I answered it.
Yeah. Connection and compassion being connected to a sense of humanity.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was something about, you asked about humanity. What does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
Yeah, what does it mean to be human? And whether we would use AI to augment ourselves, would we still be human? Well, of course we would, I think. We can't take away that, some of those pieces that I think make us human, which are those pieces of like care, love, and compassion, and our whole emotional landscape, really, I think. But I think there's elements of the emotional landscape that are unique to humans, and some researcher can probably tell you which ones they are. But I think one, I think that I don't think any other species probably has, is our ability to criticize ourselves. I don't think there's dogs or cats or bears or mountain lions that spend time thinking about themselves and thinking like they made a mistake or something like that.
That hunt went terrible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. You've mentioned compassion a few times, and you also mentioned about how AI has a bias, and there's, you know, they've found it's got a bias. How could we kind of, is it possible, do you think, to cultivate a more compassionate version of AI? And how could we go about doing that, do you think?
Well, we're definitely getting into the realm of speculation here.
Maybe the whole thing is, actually.
Well, it goes back to what I started with, which is that idea of having the brain scan of somebody who is in samadhi, in meditation, and applying that or using that to train another human.
Yeah.
So it goes without saying that why couldn't we just use that same modeling on an AI program? Of course, we still run into the same issue of who is the, what's the model brain scan? You know, where does that come from, and who's providing it, and what biases are built into that? But I think it's the responsibility of the companies to make sure that they're developing something that looks at all these questions and tries to address them. And if they find that they're not able to present or provide a tool or an AI that is not equitable, for lack of a better word, that they need to spend time and money and resources developing that. Mm. I mean, there's already a lot of criticism around ChatGPT because of the content that it has. Because the content they have is just what's on the web.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're pulling from. And so the web is full of misinformation, racist information, biased information, all that stuff. And it's all in ChatGPT.
It all comes back up. Yeah.
So it's still there. So, and it's an impossible task. Yeah. It's a human task. I mean, so for my 25 years as a librarian, this is what I taught students every day. It's like how to think about the content you're looking at.
Mm.
Who wrote it? Why did they write it? Where is it published? When was it published? That's all I taught students, was how to think about the content.
Mm.
And so now you have this ChatGPT, and it's like, you need to do the same thing with that. You need to read it, or unless you're just using it to, like, you know, write a programming script, you know, or something like that, or get you started on an idea, that sort of thing.
Mm.
But as it develops into more of an AI consciousness type of thing, you're going to have a lot of junk in there. It already has a lot of junk in there.
Yeah.
So, because it only has can source.
Yeah.
Or something brand new that came out today. Yeah. It's not going to be in there because it hasn't been put on the web yet, or, you know, it hasn't been indexed into the tool, you know, so it's not there. It's not going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, but I could go in there probably and say, you know, write me a Dharma talk modeled after Thich Nhat Hanh.
That's true, yeah.
And it might spit out something,
you know,
that I could probably start with as an idea.
Yeah.
And although a lot of his transcripts aren't on the web, they're not freely available on the web. And the books are behind paywalls, so...
So maybe you might start with a break the paywall, get the intel, then write the terrible words. So what excites you contextually as it comes down to the potential opportunity from a mindfulness point of view, wisdom, compassion? You talked about connection as well. You know, human to human, in the flesh connection. Maybe let me break this in two. The first part is about the connection. Would you say that AI can help, hinder, or help to foster more connection between people, potentially, from that point of view of being able to build community, show care and compassion, and so on?
Mm-hmm. I think it has a potential to do that, because it can be used in one way first that can hopefully guide a person towards those things like connection. So maybe you're 22, you're not comfortable going to the San Francisco Zen Center, you want to learn how to meditate, you can read a book just fine. But if you had like an AI that you could talk to, that could help you to like adjust your posture and like how can you sit so it doesn't hurt, and an AI that reminds you to say, and we already have that through our watches, but one that can like be there in a way that can like see you. This is the cool part where I think AI could go, is like where it can see you and can take that input, which that can do already because we already have facial recognition, so it could already like identify your body. The AI will know what a good posture is and then share that with the person as they're sitting, as a like a live teacher.
Wow.
Saying like, straighten your back, or put your hands at your sides, or your knees should be touching the cushion, I mean the mat. Mm-hmm. You know, all these kinds of things, just walking the person through. And even to the point that like maybe your goal is to sit for 15 minutes and 8 minutes in, you're hunched over again. And the AI can see that. Mm. And the AI is like, hey, Shamish. Dude, you got to sit up, man. Straighten your back.
Yeah.
So we have that here sometimes. So like when we have retreats on occasion, some of the elder brothers or sisters will walk around and help people adjust their posture. They'll do it at the beginning, but maybe sometime at halfway point, they might walk through and kind of like, you know, gently like, okay, straighten your shoulders or your back or whatever, and your neck. So if you had an AI that could see you doing that and can comment on what they know to be a good posture is and when you're not doing it and telling you to do it, wouldn't that be cool? And we would not need Dharma teachers anymore. We would be out of work. We wouldn't have to teach people how to meditate. We could let the AI do it.
Yeah.
Because I can imagine that.
And then that's where the connection opportunity comes.
How?
Because then you're free to go and just hang out and drink tea together.
Well, with the AI?
No,
because there's a whole lot more than just meditation, you know, to the practice.
Yeah.
In terms of other activities.
But it could be like potentially coaching you, if you like, you
know, it could be coaching you. And so
you don't want to go to the Zen center, but maybe you could walk outside and just look at it and then walk back home, and then tomorrow you can knock on the door or something. It could just nudge you.
It might build you, it might build enough confidence for you to walk through the doors of a practice center to sit, because you're like, oh, I've done this already, I've practiced. Now if you're going to go to the San Francisco Zen Center, then you need to learn how to meditate in the Soto Zen tradition, which is a slightly different sitting arrangement than what we practice in the Plum Village tradition. So the AI is going to not need to know like, well, are you going to go to Deer Park Monastery or are you going to go to San Francisco Zen Center?
Well, or then maybe advertising will start on the AI. So, you know, so, you know, the, if the Zen Center's putting more money in ads, then it starts nudging people more that way. That's potentially too. That's maybe one of the problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I think there's the realm of possibility and excitement that a very good use of AI. And when it comes to that, as long as people are able to use it as kind of a stepping stone, I think. You know, I mean, we might get to the point where you can, like, hear original Dharma talks from an AI, but we're not there yet. It's kind of like what I just said a minute ago. I can go in and type in Thich Nhat Hanh, make a Dharma talk.
Yeah.
And it's going to give me something, but would it be something I want to, like, you know, publish as, like, this is a Dharma talk by Thich Nhat Hanh? Just using different, and then who is the author at that point, you know, which is a whole other realm of this ChatGPT conversation, which we don't need to get into.
Incredible. Because I can imagine it creating talks like Thich Nhat Hanh or other teachers, and then also connecting to audio.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a teacher. So you say, can you give me a talk about
and a hologram of Tai.
And a hologram, yeah.
That they already have the deep fakes.
Yeah.
So they could totally do it. Yeah. You know, technology wise, it's totally possible.
Yeah.
We could have a live Dharma talk from it's just like, what's his name, who went on tour, that rap star from the 90s who died.
Oh, what, a hologram version of him?
Yeah, he goes out on tour.
Really?
I know there's an ABBA concert, which is all holograms in London. They built a special building. Yes,
it's the same idea, but there's there's a whole bunch of artists that have, they've done this with.
Yeah. One of the things me and Shamash were talking about a couple of months back, we're just walking through London and this saying, you know, recently AI drew a piece of art and won an award for it. And, you know, the creative process can now be hacked by AI. So let's imagine, like, the AI can now do all this fantastic stuff. Design me a building, the robots are going to build it, all of that. I guess in a way I'm circling back to the question about the suffering, but there's something about the outcome. We were talking about the outcome already being taken care of. Why does somebody write a song and publish it? Like, why do these guys do that? Are they doing it because they just want the song done? Or are they doing that because they enjoy the process of creating the song? Mm. What's your thoughts on that?
They're creators.
That space.
They're creators. They're people who want to write a song and are songwriters. They're just going to write it.
Humanity.
Yeah. You know, that sort of thing. I'm not a songwriter, so I can't say for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you can only ask an artist, but it seems to me that so much art goes unpaid anyway, and people are still writing songs. Or still making art, or still writing books, or self-publishing. I mean, I wrote on my blog for years and years, and I didn't ever get any money for it.
Hmm.
Because I enjoyed writing, and I wanted to share it with somebody, you know, so I would write.
Yeah.
So I think that will still continue.
Creation. Did we think of that?
No.
Creation is a big one. Actually, easy to talk about compassion, connection, creativity.
Yeah. One of the big C's.
And three C's. And
the fourth C is copyright.
The fourth, there's always four. Yeah, we've been talking about that.
Amazing.
I love it.
Yeah. I've just got one more question emerging, actually. And that is, are you broadly more excited by this prospect or not really? Are you indifferent about it, this turning point that we seem to be at?
I probably would land more towards the indifferent part only because I'm at a place in my life where I'm trying to shift a little bit away. I'm not as thoroughly caught up in what's happening in the technology world. I still read technology blogs. I still read Wired magazine. And so I'm still like getting little pieces of it. But through this conversation, I mean, it's exciting. But I'm also like, feel like it's going to take forever. I don't feel like it's like right around the corner. I honestly think that there's still a gap that we haven't been able to bridge just yet. And so I think I would be more excited if there was something like imminent, but I'm not sure there is something imminent. A lot of little like interesting things happening and a lot of things we don't know about. So, yeah.
Thanks for listening to our latest episode of Mindful Conversations. Join me and Calvin in the next episode as we explore this conversation together and share further insights that come up for us during our reflection. And if you like what you heard, please do leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribe and maybe share with someone who would enjoy the show. Thanks a lot and bye for now.